Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 19, The Servant of Lord Voldemort. Hermione screamed. Black leapt to his feet. Harry jumped as though he'd received a huge electric shock. I'm Matt Potts.
And I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
Hi, everyone. Just one announcement before we start today. We'd just like to remind you that you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/HarryPotterSacredText. We had a great push last month, and we've added some perks even at the lowest levels. You can now send me a photo of your pet, and I will sort it into a house.
Vanessa, this week, we are talking about virtue, and you're going to tell us a story about how virtuous you are.
I'm actually going to tell the opposite story,
okay?
Which is, I'm very excited to learn about the etymology of virtue. To me, what being virtuous means is having a value and doing everything you can to live to that value. And like, that is a virtuous life. At least that's how I think of it. So Matt, my story is actually a moment in which I feel as though I did not live virtuously, which is I am very anti-gun. I'm pro-gun restrictions and would think that the world would be better without guns. And that is a virtue that I feel like I get to live in the world quite easily. I do not own a gun. I do not have a lot of friends who own guns. So I get to just sort of feel this way and not have that tested very frequently. And then a couple of years ago, we were doing a live show for Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, I guess about 5-6 years ago now. And I had gotten a couple of threatening emails from someone who was frustrated by my feminism. And I felt very loved with how our team responded to that. Our musician, Nick Bull, was like sort of dedicated to keeping an eye out for me. Ariana and Casper were very concerned. The venue, you know, was double checking IDs to make sure no one who wasn't on the list came in. You know, there were like efforts at keeping me safe. And as I said, I felt very loved, but I did not feel safe that night. I was very scared all night. And the person who'd sent me the threatening email did in fact come up to talk to me after the show, and it went fine. And again, like Nick was right there and other people were watching, but it was a very tense evening. Well, then more recently, about 3 years ago now, we were doing a live show at a synagogue and the venue started getting emails threatening me as a Jew who had spoken openly about feminism and feminist ideas, and we'd had an article written about the show. And so the venue, I arrived, and the venue was like, look, you know, you have been getting these threatening emails all day, so we have hired an armed guard to stand with you. And I loved having an armed guard. He came with me everywhere. He like waited outside of the bathroom for me. He like walked me to my car at the end of the night. And I did. I just felt safe all night. He was at the lip of the stage in case anybody walked up toward the stage. While I felt loved at the previous incident, I did not feel safe. I was very on edge all night. And so having this armed guard, I really knew the difference. And it was just interesting how much I enjoyed something that I thought I was so morally against. And that to me was a moment of leaving virtue behind because of a specific situation. Because if virtue is making sacrifices in order to live up to our values, I, as soon as a sacrifice was being asked from me, was like, values, schmalues.
I don't know if I agree, Vanessa. Is that okay? I mean, given your definition of virtue, where you say virtue is living into a value, right? Consistently and thoughtfully. I think maybe the value, the underlying value here is that people deserve to be safe, right? The reason you want to get rid of the excess guns in the world is because people deserve to be safe. And the reason why it made sense, even though it seems contrary to that policy decision, to have an armed guard in this particular instance is that people deserve to be safe. Now, I mean, that's where it gets complicated because lots of folks have different definitions of what keeps us safe. That's what, right? But I think that the virtue, I mean, you could think, given the definition you gave, I think that you don't need to necessarily call yourself a hypocrite. You just are looking at, like, there's a deeper value that underlies your opinions about things. But the value is people deserve to be safe, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Or am I trying to save you too much?
No, I appreciate it. I know how I rationalized it, right? And like that is one of the ways that I rationalized it.
Yeah.
But I think that if living in a gun-free world was really my highest priority, I would not, in front of 600 people, have someone standing there holding a gun.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. I don't think that living in a gun-free world is your highest priority. I think that you have reasoned that outlawing most guns, maybe all guns, would make the world much safer, which is what you actually value. I mean, you asked about the etymology of virtue, and this is an interesting case where the etymology of virtue shows us the limit of etymology as a strategy for thinking through these things. Because the word virtue comes from the Latin vir, which means man, and it just meant to be manly. Like, right? Ugh. So there was this comes out of very patriarchal Roman culture where sort of being a Roman soldier was understood as sort of the pinnacle of human achievement. And so things that Roman soldiers were valued for, like courage and fearlessness in battle and sacrifice and these kinds of things, those were understood to be virtues. And so it derives from the word vir. I think that etymology was actually really interesting for this chapter, which we'll talk about more. But to your point, the Latin word for virtue is translating an original Greek word, which is hexis, which is Aristotle's definition. Aristotle loves virtue, this ancient Greek philosopher, and he builds his whole system of ethics around virtue. And his definition is like yours. His is like, what are the habits and dispositions and ways of life that we can cultivate in ourselves so that we can contribute to our own and others' flourishing, right? So, like, it's a way of being in the world. It's what character traits, dispositions that help you live into your values, right? So the more ancient Greek definition is the one that accords with yours, but there is this weird, like, Roman transformation of it that genders it and associates it with things like courage and bravery and fearsomeness and fearlessness in battle.
Okay, Matt, it is your time to start the 30-second recap, and so much happens in this chapter. So I wish you the best of luck.
I feel totally at ease about this.
Oh, good for you. It's like a novel's worth.
I've never felt more easy about a 30-second recap. So let's go. Let's do it. Guess what, Vanessa? I'm ready.
I believe in you. On your mark. Get set. Go.
So Snape shows up and Snape is like, aha, I caught you. And people want to talk to him. He's like, no, I'm shouting at you. Don't talk to me. And then the three kids, Expelliarmus at the same time, and he gets knocked out. And they're like, oh, Sirius, explain your story to us. And like, Sirius is like, okay, I will, but let me kill the rat. And they're like, no, you can't kill the rat. You have to explain your story. And there's a very long explanation of the story. And then Pettigrew is made to emerge. And then he begs everyone to spare his life. And no one wants to. And they're about to kill him. But Harry says, no, I'm going to spare your life, but not for you, for my father. And then Lupin ties him up and they get Snape to follow him out.
That was really good.
Thanks. Okay, Vanessa, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, go.
So Hermione is mediating this like very complicated situation. She's like, okay, everybody put your wands down except for me who just stunned Snape, and everyone just explain what's going on. And Sirius is like, I was the secret keeper, but I thought that Voldemort was going to attack me and find out. And so I made Peter the secret keeper. But Peter, it turns out, worked for Voldemort the entire time. And he's a really bad guy and he's weak and he should have been willing to die for Lily and James.
What a team.
Honestly, what a team.
I thought it was amazing because, as you have reminded me several times, this is a team effort. It's not a competition. And if you'll notice from my 30-second recap, I skipped over the middle part where the details of this very complicated story of deception, where all those details are revealed. And you carried our listeners quite quickly and clearly through that long and complicated story. Brava, Vanessa.
Well, thank you, sir.
So at the end of this chapter, like, Pettigrew has emerged. He's been forced to reveal himself by Sirius and Lupin. And he's still trying to make up excuses. He's still trying to continue to persuade people of the lie that he has spent the last 13 years persuading them of. And he's failing, and he knows he's about to die. And he goes and he's groveling towards the children to kind of for them to advocate on behalf of his life. But what he really comes across as what you said, as very weak and cowardly, and not just to the reader. Characters in the book, I think it's Sirius, says, like, you always needed to be by someone strong.
Yeah.
When we were in school, you had to be by James and me. And then you found a stronger person who was Voldemort. And so you ran for him because he was stronger, because you are weak. And so this is my question, because like you, I don't like that Roman definition of virtue. I don't like the idea that virtue is a particular kind of martial bravery, like a willingness to fight and harm others and sacrifice oneself bodily. Like, maybe those are virtues in cases, but for that to be the whole definition of virtue, which is what the Roman definition was, worries me. But it seems to me that if the opposite of virtue is vice, that what we are shown here in this chapter is that the fundamental flaw here with Peter Pettigrew is not that he's evil, but that he's weak. Like, weakness really is the problem here. Weakness really is the thing that allows all this evil to return. It allowed the murder of Harry's family so many years ago. It's going to allow the resurrection of Voldemort now. And I don't know how I feel about weakness being so closely allied with evil, right? Does that follow when we think of courage as a virtue? I don't know. Help me think through this, Vanessa.
Yeah. I mean, I'll start with the Jewish answer, which I don't know if I agree with or not. But in Judaism, it is never considered a responsibility for you to sacrifice your own life. Yeah. It is always a virtue to save a life, but that includes your own life. And rabbis are really clear about that. And therefore, sacrificing your own life is its own, not sin, right? But it's definitely not encouraged. And that is the thing that Sirius yells at him, right? Like, you should have died for your friends rather than betray your friends. And I think that that is a lot to ask from someone. The ways to critique Peter, to me, are that he was spineless, right? Which I'm trying to figure out if that is the same thing as weak. He didn't stand for anything. He stood for, I mean, arguably something similar to what I stood for, which is always feeling a sense of safety and not worried about the risk that his own safety might create a lack of safety for others. And I respect someone like Snape more than someone like Peter. I disagree with Snape, but Snape believes what he believes and sticks to it, whereas I find something really repugnant, and I'm not sure if it's fair, about someone who's just willing to, like, go where the wind takes them.
Yeah, I think that's right. But don't you think that the root flaw then is some kind of weakness in Pettigrew? Because I think you're right. I mean, Christian ethics is less decisive on the question of when you ought to sacrifice yourself. It's certainly not clear. I think some people think that Christian ethics means you must sacrifice yourself, and I think that's a misreading. But regardless of that, I think with Pettigrew, though, like, it's as the secret keeper, now he's the one who's going to be tortured, right?
Right.
So it really is him saving his own skin. He has to choose between saving his own skin or turning to Voldemort, the strong one, and becoming his servant. And so for Peter, like, you know, it's one of those situations where, yeah, I mean, I also don't think we should ever advocate, especially for the weak, to to sacrifice themselves. But I also get what Sirius is saying when he says, like, I mean, Sirius could have said this much more gently. He has a lot of anger and resentment after all his time in Azkaban, but I'm sorry the choice you were left with was be tortured by Voldemort or turn over to Voldemort, but that was the choice you were given, and you made the bad one. And you made that bad one because you were weak and cowardly and not brave enough like all us Gryffindors, right? Which is for whom it comes so easily or so naturally or something. I don't know. I agree with everything you've just said, really. And the reason I raise the question is I really worry about associating weakness with evil, because that's the strategy of the strong. And that's a strategy of authoritarians who actually try to accrue more power and punish the marginalized and ostracize and harm those who have less power. But I wonder if there's a little bit of that operating even in the critique of Peter here.
Yeah. And the thing that complicates this, I think, is at least how I understand some of Sirius's accusations. It's also, you are always playing both sides. You were, yeah, right? Like, he was the mole. He was the reason that there had to be a secret keeper.
Yeah.
He was the one handing information to Voldemort. And yeah, I don't know where, right? Like, I don't know where the line is within myself, because I want people to stand for something, but I also don't want them to sacrifice themselves. And the lines on those things are really complicated. I think that the truth is, the reason that I think that I have both of those beliefs is because we live in an imperfect world, and a virtue is about, to some extent, an ideal circumstance, right? It's really easy to live a virtuous life when everyone has enough water and everyone has enough food and everyone has enough mental health care, right? Like, we can be generous to one another when we have more than enough.
Yeah.
It's much harder to be generous when we don't.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, where Peter's weakness comes from is what complicates all of this for me.
Yeah. I mean, this is really interesting, because that's why I mentioned Aristotle earlier. That's why he calls virtues habits or traits that you cultivate, right? It's not like something that is just in you and given to you, and it's not like an excellence that just like appears in the moment of crisis. It's actually something you work on every day, right? I work on overcoming my weaknesses or my vices every day, so that in the moment of crisis, in the imperfect moment where there is no easy decision, because I've cultivated that habit, I can be trusted to make the best decision in an imperfect world. Maybe not one that is perfect, because there's no perfect option, but if I spend time cultivating the habit, trying to be courageous, even if it doesn't come naturally to me, right, then maybe in the moment when I need courage, I will do the right thing. Yeah, and so I think that's really important too, right, that we think about virtues not as things that take place in an ideal world, but as habits and traits that we try to cultivate to reckon with a world that never meets us the way we want it to, and that needs us to respond in imperfect ways, but ways that we're still responsible for, right? Ways that we still have to take accountability for. Yeah.
I mean, that was the very first story that we told on Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, was the story of the Huguenot town in France that practiced radical hospitality in a daily way in their lives. They had trap doors built into their houses. They had sheets in their closets. And so when Jews needed a safe harbor in France, right, like, they were ready. And I love that idea about us getting ourselves ready.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of work, and it's a big commitment. The thing, in addition to Peter Pettigrew's weakness, that I think we can critique is, you made the wrong choice because you had to live for 13 years as a rat, right? Like, like, people think of life and death, and I can imagine being like, look, I'm just protecting myself. But what life is he living now, right? Like, he's a rat in fear of Sirius, and then he is going to live with Voldemort and cut off his own hand for Voldemort. Yeah. And so to me, the story of Peter Pettigrew is also a story of, like, the costs of not having integrity, right? Like, there's a risk to integrity, but the risk to not having integrity is that you have to live with yourself and a version of yourself that sounds really unjoyful to live.
Yeah. And if we're to believe Sirius, he's also been afraid all this time of the Death Eaters who are looking for him, right? So that to spare his own life, he's just placed himself in the same situation where he's always constantly terrified for his life. And also just this question of self-sacrifice is really complicated with Pettigrew, because Voldemort demands such subservience and kind of abject devotion, self-erasure, really. I mean, it's in an interesting way, it's foreshadowed or prefigured by the initial explosion that led to Sirius's arrest, because he cut off a finger in that instance to save his life.
Yeah.
And next season, they cut off a hand to save his life, yeah. Right? And Peter's attempt to avoid risk means these, like, kind of progressive acts of self-destruction, right? Or self-harm. Yeah, it's really, it's, Peter's such a tragic character. I mean, I found myself really bothered reading it because yeah. I've, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, the way that characters are drawn in the novels, I worry about, you know, kind of the somatic and bodily representations of who is weak and who is strong and who is good and who is evil. And I don't like how this, you know, ostensibly evil or at least weak character is drawn physically by the books as frail and unattractive. And I think he's balding, right? Like, I don't like those.
Shorter than Harry and Hermione.
And he's shorter than the children. Like, the associations are prejudicial and I don't like it. And on the contrary, I didn't find myself, like, hating him. I felt myself really, like, pitying him. Maybe that's what the novel's trying to make me do. But he seems like a really tragic character.
Yeah.
And I felt a lot of, even though he is certainly complicit in absolutely evil things, the deaths of Muggles and the deaths of many others, I also found him a really, like, tragic, tragic character.
Yeah. And how we hold tragic characters like that to account is just a really interesting question. I do really feel for him. And yet I just also know within myself that I find it repulsive.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So Snape thinks he's living virtuously, right? The way that he comes into this room.
Yep.
He's like, ah, justice, finally. He comes in very, like, masculine, macho, right? Like, he even does this sort of Trojan horse thing of using the invisibility cloak. And I find him repugnant in this scene.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because he's so triumphant. You can tell that he's so happy to have caught not just Lupin, but he's also so happy to catch the kids, right? And his feelings of triumph in catching the kids and catch, it's like every person he resents at the school, right? This trio and that trio from his own days, he gets to catch them all at once and win over all of them. And so he just starts yelling at everybody. You're right. It is this kind of Roman macho thing. You know, if we're thinking about virtue as a habit you cultivate, the reason he catches them is because he's doing something virtuous, right? We hear at the beginning of the chapter that Snape realizes Lupin forgot to take his wolfsbane this month, and so he concocted up the potion for him and is taking it to him, right? He's doing his duty. He's like, here's a guy I don't like who bullied me when I was a kid, but he deserves not to have to suffer for 2 or 3 days this month. So even though he forgot to ask me and I could let him suffer, I am going to brew him his wolfsbane and take it to him,
which is like, that's what Aristotle's talking about. You practice the habit, you do the thing, and then in the moment of crisis, you will do the right thing because you've habituated yourself to doing the right thing. And that's not at all what happens in the scene. Like, he's been making Wolfsbane for Lupin forever. He texts him in this instance. But then when he sees the moment, he has no patience. He does not want to hear Lupin talk. He does not want to hear an explanation. He just wants to shout at everybody, tie him up, and let the Death Eaters suck the souls out of them.
And he's gleeful about it, which is what I find so offensive. And just, like, completely unwilling to listen. Like, he is exploiting this moment.
Yeah. Yeah, not just let's send him back to Azkaban, but let's have the Dementors suck the souls out of both of you when as soon as we get back to Hogwarts. Like, it's gleefully cruel, which is just really, really disturbing.
And I think that the moment that I find most troubling is when Hermione is trying to explain it to him.
Yeah.
And he not only is mean in how he shuts up Hermione, but he's like, I don't want to listen, right? Like, I have caught you in a way that will allow me to treat you poorly. I don't care what's really going on. And that lack of curiosity, right, like, is one of the ways that at least Stephanie Paulsell talks about being profane, right, is like when something is no longer open and generous and curious and hopeful, that is when it becomes profane. And like this to me is profane, is to close your eyes to the complexities of a situation and be like, nope, technically I caught you.
Yep.
There's just something so deeply cynical about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're also, I mean, you spoke of the gleefulness, which is a great word. I think there's also something about Hermione is a great student, and Hermione usually knows the right answer, right?
Yeah.
And as a teacher at the school, he usually has to begrudgingly kind of accept that she knows the right answer and or maybe make a sharp comment when she makes the right answer. But here he gets to tell her, no, you don't know what you're talking about, which is what he...
Yeah.
Right, it just reveals, like, this resentment that's always been there, even for this well-intentioned, excellent student whose only desire is to please her teachers, right? Like... He still he thinks of her as a know-it-all too, and that's why he loves telling her she doesn't know what she's talking about in this chapter, which is, it's just revealing a bad side of Snape.
Which also, like, one of the amazing things about it is that, you know, the 13-year-old girl is still right.
It's still right, absolutely, absolutely.
And so he's just, again, proving the ways that this kind of virtuous machismo is...
Yeah.
Just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I will say that at first, Hermione is glad that an authority has arrived, right? She's like, we're up here, right? And then it's like, oh, a teacher's arrived. Like, something good is going to happen, right? Like, the truth is going to be able to get sorted out now. And then again, Snape just betrays that entirely.
Yeah. There are a couple other instances of virtue I hope we can hit.
Please.
Especially if we think about virtue as a habit cultivated so that in the moment of crisis, we react in the right way or in a way that protects others or ourselves. One of my favorite moments in this chapter is when, unspoken, without plan, the three children at the exact same time all cast an Expelliarmus curse. Now, this leads to too much because it concusses Snape, which is not what any of the three of them intended. But
it doesn't just concuss him. It knocks him out.
Yes, right. Knocks him out and he's bleeding, right? From the head. And everyone's fairly unconcerned. But to me, this speaks to, like, the idea of virtue as a habit. Like, we have 2¾, maybe 2¾ books of these three children, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, having routinely practiced being courageous, sticking up for each other, taking action when necessary, not trusting adults when adults let you down, like all these things, so that in this moment of crisis, when things really are about to get bad, the three of them just spontaneously exemplify the same virtue and take the identical action at the same time. It's charming because they're such three different characters. Their personalities are so different. But having practiced for almost three books these particular traits in their adventures together, they all kind of instinctively do the same thing at the same time.
Yeah, and it's just trying to disarm, right? They weren't trying to hurt him at all. It's just like really beautiful instinct.
Right, exactly, right.
Oh, I absolutely love it. And they are. They are sadly at the age of 13, super practiced in this.
Yep, they've developed a habit.
It is disturbing.
Yep. Yeah.
What do you make of the moment, Matt, in which Harry says, "Let's not kill Peter. My dad would not want for the two of you to become murderers." Do you feel like it's fair for him to be talking on behalf of a man who he doesn't really know?
Well, that's the other situation in Virtue I wanted to talk about. Like, is this, I'd be interested to hear what you think about that. I think the way you frame it is really interesting. Is so you're asking, what do I think about him saying my dad would not want him?
Yeah.
Want you two to become killers. My dad would not want his friends to become killers. I don't know if I think that's true. What do you think, Vanessa? I mean, my reading is going to go against the spoken words of Harry himself, so I'm going to hold it back for a second.
Yeah. I think, like, the more honest thing to say, where Harry actually takes ownership of his own feelings, and again, I am not criticizing this 13-year-old child.
Yep.
I'm just, you know, saying that I think that the way to go is to say, I don't want my dad's best friends to become murderers.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't want my best friends to become murderers for me. And so I don't want you to become murderers for my dad. There's just something weird about not taking responsibility or credit for the instinct. It's a beautiful instinct, and it's Harry's instinct. And if he's inspired by the idea of his father, great.
Yeah.
But I still think, like, I don't want you to do that out of honor to my father, whatever.
Yeah, I agree. Because I honestly, we don't have a lot of characterization of James in these novels. And who knows how James would have changed these last 13 years had he been alive.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think if James is in the room with Remus and Sirius, the three of them kill Peter together. I mean, I think that,
yeah.
I don't know why James would feel so different from Sirius or Remus. That's why I think, I don't know if I believe it when Harry says that.
Well, I mean, I do think that one of the things that's brilliant about this scene is that it puts us in the same position of Harry. Yeah. Harry doesn't want his dad's best friends to become killers, and we don't want Harry to become a killer.
Yeah.
It also feels like what Harry wants is for the world to make sense.
Yeah.
Right? And he's like, it doesn't make sense if my father's best friends are murderers, right? Yeah. Like, it doesn't make sense if Lupin is attacked for being a good werewolf or if Sirius is. Like, he is trying to restore a sense of logic to this unruly world, a moral logic.
Yeah.
And I think that that is part of what makes Harry beautiful, is his, like, constant desire to restore a sense of justice to the world.
Yeah. If we understand this as a virtuous stance that Harry makes, and I don't know if we do. I mean, I think...
Well, it strategically backfires.
It strategically backfires. That's what I mean, right? I think I could be open to people saying that it wasn't virtuous. But even if we understand it that way, or even if we don't, like, what are the habits that he has cultivated to take this stand in this moment? Like, this is a difficult moment for him, right? Like, these people he respects, Remus, and I think he's come to respect Sirius really suddenly when he hears this full story. Like, these people who knew his parents, these people are saying the person who killed your parents deserves to die. I mean, he's 13. There's a lot going on in this room. And something gives rise to him taking this action. Like, what? Maybe it's all the courage that he's practiced. Maybe it's his suspicion of adults and their ability to care for him throughout these books. Maybe that's why he's willing to stand up for himself here or stand up for what he believes, even if it does strategically backfire. If this is a virtue, what are the habits that he's cultivated that leads him to enact this virtue now?
I mean, I also think one of the ways that we see abuse bear out is that people sort of either continue the cycle of abuse or are able to resist it.
Hmm.
And Harry grew up as a victim of abuse and I think is going to spend his life trying really hard to resist perpetuating that cycle. He sees the monstrousness of the Dursleys and I think it's really possible that he is...
Yeah.
You know, trying to say, like, I will never be that. I will never do that.
Yeah.
And that is its own kind of commitment, right? Of, like, I do not want to be anything like that.
Yeah, right. And also that, like, I hadn't really thought of this before, but, like, the Dursleys and Vernon especially, and Dudley too, totally exemplify this Roman idea of virtue, which is, like, machismo, power is what counts. Being strong is what counts. Being loud and brash and abusive is what counts. And weakness is to be beaten out of you, right? And so you could see how the revelation of this character who is so weak could arouse maybe not sympathy, but yeah, pity in Harry, or at least a reluctance to become too much like the Dursleys, too much like what he suffered under for 11 years.
Yeah.
So, Vanessa, this week, our spiritual practice is the practice of Florilegium, where each of us will choose a line from the chapter, what we call a sparklet, to read alongside one another and see what new meanings or ideas emerge. So do you have a sentence that you've selected for us?
I do. It is, "There's nothing seriously wrong with him."
Interesting. Who is the him here?
So the him is Snape, and okay. It's Lupin who's talking, and it's after the kids have expelliarmused Snape to a prone figure, you know, just like passed out on the ground.
Yeah.
And what does seriously wrong with someone mean? There are a lot of things seriously wrong with Snape.
Yeah.
He is passed out on the floor. So there's that. He's also deeply enraged.
Yeah.
There's that. I find it just interesting on a like, what, to quote Princess Bride, "I don't think that means what you think it means." Like, there are a lot of things seriously wrong with Snape in this moment. And I just know that I've had moments like that, right? Where someone will like hold me and be like, "It'll be fine." And I'm like, "No, it will be changed forever," right? Like, these things that we say to soothe are often just like deeply, deeply untrue.
Yeah.
Or at least speculative, right? If someone's like, "You'll be okay," I'm like, "You don't know that?" Anyway, yeah. That is why this sparkles up at me, is because it is, Lupin is saying it in order to assuage the concerns of the children. I think it works. I think they're like, "Oh, yeah, he's fine."
Yeah.
But it is just, it's a lie. I'm not even sure Lupin knows it's a lie, but it's a lie.
And if I remember correctly, this happens right when they start to move Snape at the end of the chapter, right? So there's been like a whole chapter and this whole story told where Snape has been lying bleeding on the ground. And then I don't know if Lupin has like a meta scan spell where he just,
right?
He's just like, "Oh, he's fine. He looks okay. Don't worry about that blood coming from his head." Right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. It's a curious statement.
What about you, Matt? What sentence sparkled up at you?
My sentence is this. "Black's face looked more skull-like than ever as he stared at Pettigrew with his fathomless eyes."
Ooh, yeah, where's that from?
This moment happens almost immediately after Peter has been transformed back into his human shape, human status, or whatever.
Form?
But, yeah, form, I guess, transformed back into his human form by Remus and Sirius. And Sirius really wants to kill Peter, and he is looking at him hatefully. And I guess I just sparkled up at me because I like the description. I mean, the more skull-like than ever is what's making him look more skull-like, this hatefulness, like this fact that he is feeling this hate so acutely in the moment, is just about to kill or just about to try to kill Peter, and that's what makes his face skull-like. And I also just like the idea of his fathomless eyes. First of all, because this modifier is dangling, right? We actually don't know whose eyes are fathomless. I think that it's Black's eyes that are meant to be fathomless because he's the one that's staring. But presumably he's also staring into Peter's eyes. And we hear a lot about how kind of beady Peter's eyes are elsewhere in the book. I don't know, the fact that both of them are emptied out somehow, right? That the life that they have been living for the last 13 years, that both of them, their souls have been emptied or somehow so that their eyes could be fathomless. There's a reciprocity or a mirroring there, which I think the grammatical unclarity actually serves to draw out.
Hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. And I'm just trying to conjure what it means to have fathomless eyes. It's eyes that can't understand what they're seeing, right?
Yeah, maybe, because fathom isn't a term to understand, right? Like, I couldn't fathom that. I was thinking about fathom as like depth, right? So something that's fathomless, I think, is like depthless. Like they go on forever. You look into the eyes and there's no, right? That's why I was thinking about emptiness. Like if you look into an eye, like looking down an abyss or a pit that has no bottom, right?
Yeah.
An abyss that was fathomless would be one that went down forever, right? And so like looking into these eyes, there's just like this deep emptiness behind them. And I think that deep emptiness could characterize either Pettigrew or Black.
Absolutely. And that certainly they're fathomless when looking at each other, right?
Yeah.
There's just nothing but pain and betrayal and these like
and hatred
deep
and fear
wells of
yeah. Okay, let's put them together.
Great.
There's nothing seriously wrong with him. Black's face looked more skull-like than ever as he stared at Pettigrew with his fathomless eyes.
I mean, it works really well.
I mean, in the sense that you were looking, that you were talking about your sentence, which is like
you're
trying to paper over a deep problem, right? Oh, there's nothing wrong with him. And then you see his skull-like face and his fathomless eyes. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it again feels like the way that you'll often hear like doctors who understandably see the world differently than we do, right? We'll look at a cancer patient and be like, oh, they're fine. And you're like, except for the fact that they're riddled with cancer, right?
Yeah,
and so it's just like the two of these sentences together, like, right, this like diagnostic, his face looked more skull-like than ever as he did, right? Like it's almost reporting.
Yeah.
And then it's like, based on these facts, I still feel comfortable saying there's nothing seriously wrong with him. It's just amazing the things that we stop seeing as wrong with other people or, right, like, you can walk in a prison and be like, oh, everything here is in order. And it's like, well, is it? We've put humans in cages.
Yeah. I'm going to read them in the other order, Vanessa. I have a feeling we're going to have a very similar reading, but who knows what will emerge because we are open and curious and these lines are sacred.
That is a profane point of
view. Right. Let's keep it sacred. Keep it sacred, folks. Okay. Black's face looked more skull-like than ever as he stared at Pettigrew with his fathomless eyes. There's nothing seriously wrong with him.
Oh, that changes.
Ooh, I did get a different meaning.
Yeah, what did you get?
I did. See, we are keeping it sacred. Because now this looks like everything I was saying before that like, oh, Pettigrew is too weak for us to murder him. Even if we resent him, he should have our pity. It's almost like this is Black speaking now and rendering judgment on Pettigrew, which is like, there's no reason to be sympathetic to him. There's no reason we need to show mercy now because there's nothing wrong with him in the sense that would mitigate our decision or our rationale for our actions.
Yeah, it reminds me of this term that I learned from Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde of mens rea, which means like guilty mind. And right, like reading the sentences in this order is Black hating Peter Pettigrew and saying, and the worst of it is that he's in his right mind, right? Like that there's nothing wrong with him. There's no reason to pity him. Yeah, he's making this choice. And whether or not we ever really want to look at someone with those eyes, right?
Well, thanks. I was skeptical about a new meaning emerged, but I think we got a really great one. That second reading, I think, was really, it really opened up Black's character in interesting ways. That's great. Thanks, Vanessa. Thanks for doing this with me.
You can also measure the success of a spiritual practice by whether or not I get to mention Legally Blonde. So thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
We now have a voice memo from Jessica. And just a warning, Jessica is going to mention some of the recent shootings that we've had in the United States. And if you would rather not hear those crimes referenced or hear us talk about them, please skip ahead a bit.
Hi, Harry Potter and the Sacred Text team. This is Jessica. I'm listening to your episode on Book 3, Chapter 14, and about wisdom, and about how Hogwarts seems to be implementing all the wrong, unwise solutions in the wake of the attack by Sirius. I'm calling in on May 26th, just a couple of days after a horrendous school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, not that far from my home. And I cannot help but see the parallels between what Hogwarts is doing and what we as a nation are doing. Like the people at Hogwarts, we know what the problem is, but we're implementing the wrong decisions. We're making the wrong judgments. Instead of addressing the problem of guns and of white supremacy and of the issues that lead so many young white men to carry out attacks like this, we are instead turning again to the schools and saying, you must solve this problem. You must have better drills. You must have your teachers armed against intrusions. You must be the solution to a problem that we have created. We have the knowledge that this is not the answer. We know that there are nations around the world who do not experience school shootings at the rate that we do in the ways that we do. And yet, instead of implementing solutions, making judgments that would fix the problem, we're doing the unwise thing. And people are dying. Dying in schools, in grocery stores, at movie theaters, in their houses of worship, and so many other places. I hope that we can look at a text like this and see how unwise it is, and then carry that out into the world. For is that not what you are trying to do in reading this text sacredly? Thank you for all you do.
Jessica, thank you so much for this really impassioned voicemail. I think we're just really grateful to have these things shared from a different voice, things that we are also passionate about.
Thank you, Jessica.
It is now time for us to honor people who have been loved and lost. A listener submitted the names of the victims of the shooting in Buffalo, New York. And so those are the names that we will be reading today. Roberta A. Drury, who is 32. Margus D. Morrison, 52. Andre McNeil, who is 53. Aaron Salter, who is 55. Geraldine Talley, who is 62. Celestine Cheney, who is 65. Hayward Patterson, who is 67. Catherine Massey, who was 72. Pearl Young, who was 77. And Ruth Whitfield, who was 86. May their memories be a blessing to us all. Matt, now it's time for us to offer blessings for characters in the chapter. Who would you like to bless?
You know, Vanessa, I think I want to bless Harry. I feel like I consciously try to avoid blessing Harry. I think because he's the protagonist, right? And so I'm trying to look in some of the corners where other people are doing important or heroic things, or just things that deserve our recognition. And again, like you said in this conversation, strategically, it may be the wrong decision to spare Peter. But yeah, I respect Harry for making this choice, even if the reason he gives is not one I find especially believable. And taking the stand in this moment, and the stand that he does, erring on the side of mercy, to me, that's a virtue and took some courage and resolve and integrity for Harry to do that. And so blessings to him for it. Who are you blessing, Vanessa?
I want to bless Ron. There is a moment at the end of the chapter where Sirius says that two of us should be chained to Peter just to make sure he doesn't run off, and that Peter has been threatened if he, you know, turns into a rat. And Ron says that he'll do it, that he will chain himself to Peter. And then later it says Ron's face was set. He seemed to have taken Scabbers' true identity as a personal insult. Hmm. And I think that we as humans have an instinct to blame ourselves for things that aren't our faults, right? We'll often be like, oh, if I would have gone to the doctor sooner, I would have noticed, whatever it is, when really it's just the bad thing's fault, right? Ron didn't do anything wrong in sheltering Peter Pettigrew. He thought he had a pet. And yeah. So I just want to bless him for taking responsibility for something that wasn't even his doing and just say, like, he did nothing wrong. Say to all of our listeners that we often find ourselves in situations in which we're blaming ourselves and we didn't do anything wrong. And I hope that you can forgive yourself for those moments. So Matt, next week we're going to be reading book 3, chapter 20, The Dementor's Kiss, through the theme of confidence.
Confidence. Great. This has been a Not Sorry production, and Not Sorry Productions is a feminist production company. Our executive producer is Ariana Nettleman. We are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas. Our engineer is Erica Wong. Our music is by Ivan Paisal and Nick Boll, and we are distributed by Acast. Special thanks this week to Jessica for their voicemail, to Lara Glass, Julia Argy, Gabby Iori, Nikki Zoltan, Casper Terkyle, Stephanie Paulsell, Hannah Rehak, and to the listener who sent in the names of those who were killed in the Buffalo shooting.
Episode. Everyone, just so you know, I'm recording in Cammie's room today, and so it might be a little echoey, but I'm worth it. And it's because we are making improvements to our home. The state of Massachusetts is insulating our house so it can be more energy efficient. And Matt has generously offered that I record at his house. Anyway, blooper reel, that's why the episode sounds weird.
Chapter 19.